From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Vermont psychologist Bruce Chalmer, whose new book is Reigniting the Spark: Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. Dr. Chalmer has been working with couples for over 30 years, as well as teaching, consulting, and producing YouTube videos about relationships for couples and their therapists. Dr. Chalmer's background and active participation in Jewish tradition is a central influence on his work. He has wide experience counseling people of many faiths for whom spirituality and religion are central. He has also served in leadership positions in Jewish communities in Vermont and is a musician and composer. He lives in South Burlington with his wife, Judy Alexander. Reigniting the Spark focuses on how to build a lasting relationship full of passion and fulfillment to improve communication, have better sex, and avoid pointless arguments. Dr. Chalmer combines his expertise in science with 30 years of experience as a couples therapist to offer ideas about how to restore intimacy and overcome problems, and to create and maintain a lively, loving, lasting relationship. The book's aim is to help readers better understand themselves and their partners. Its lessons include how to build and restore intimacy, trust, and a deep connection in your relationship, how to identify triggering issues like trauma that could be sapping the joy out of your relationship, and exactly what to do about it, a list of bad reasons people get married, and one good one, how to go from plain old sex to good sex to sacred sex, how to be your best self when your partner has been unfaithful, how to know when to break up and when to work through the inevitable growing pains in your relationship. When I spoke with Bruce Chalmer, I began by asking how he came to write Reigniting the Spark. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I've been doing the work. I've been a therapist and especially more and more a couples therapist. I've always enjoyed it. I've been more and more focusing on that. And I've been doing that for decades now. And I'm trying to remember how many years ago, 7, 8, 9 years ago, something like that, I started doing videos just because it was kind of fun to do. So I did a bunch of YouTube videos. The first one I did was called Couples Therapy in 7 Words, because I had this 7-word formula. And of course, that's in the book.
Yes. And in my questions.
Great. And I did that one, and I did a bunch of other videos on various other topics just because it was kind of fun to do. It's also a way of, publicizing my practice. And then I realized a couple of years ago that I had the makings of a book there. I'd covered a bunch of topics that I was really quite passionate about. And I thought, well, I could turn this into a book. And so that's really how the book came to be.
Okay, great. And we can talk more about the process of writing the book as we go. I wanted to also talk a little bit about your life and background and the way it affects your practice. And you do talk about that in the book. So you talk about your Jewish faith sometimes coming into play when you're with your clients, not always, but sometimes, and also your background as a statistician. You write, "It informs my understanding of science's role in how we make sense of the world and how we can apply scientific findings to the practice of therapy." And I thought both of those were interesting, and together they're interesting. So do you want to talk about that?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Yeah, I don't think I quite realized until I pulled it together and talking about how those things influence me. I don't think I quite realized how well they fit together, that statistics is a lot about uncertainty. It's a lot about grasping the fact that we don't have complete information and nevertheless trying to understand the world as well as we can. And when I talk about the role of science in doing this sort of work, a lot of it is recognizing that we do live in uncertainty. And so we have to be able to understand multiple possibilities. Mm-hmm. And that fits very well with a Jewish understanding of the world as well. The entire Talmud is a bunch of arguments. And all sides of the arguments are given great respect. And it's fairly rare, actually, in the Talmud that they actually say, well, this is right and the rest of it is wrong. They don't do that. They say the arguments are really important. So that, the scientific understanding that says, yes, much of what we're dealing with is uncertain And so we have to be able to understand things from multiple points of view. And then the Jewish perspective, which says, yes, it's in embracing the uncertainties that growth occurs. Mm-hmm. Those, they come together nicely, and it really informs how I do my work.
Right. And there's not a lot of Judaism in your book, although I do think you occasionally put in just the perfect story to sort of support your point. You know, I'm trying to remember, I think at the beginning you talk a little bit about the rabbi who was asked to stand on one foot and explain the Torah. And that's such a great story. You want to just tell us that one real quick?
Yes, of course. And it's extremely well known. It's not an obscure one, you know. Right. Yeah, it was Hillel. A scoffer came to Hillel and challenged him to explain. He said, I'll become Jewish if you can explain the whole Torah to me. Well, I think it was the scoffer standing on one foot, which is to say, you know, he was obviously being dismissive. He was saying, you know, obviously this is nonsense. You couldn't possibly do it. And Hillel took up the challenge. He said, sure, no problem. What is hateful to you, don't do to your neighbor. That's the whole Torah. The rest is commentary. Now go and learn. So I took that, you know, having come up with my own little, rather presumptuously, I would say, having come up with my own little formula to summarize, you know, the project of being a couple, I said, well, and we can get into I'll say what the formula was.
Yes.
My formula that I developed was be kind, don't panic, and have faith. And that's what you need to know about relationships. The rest is commentary. Now go and learn.
Right.
And of course, now go and learn is a really important part of it. It's like Hillel wasn't saying, well, that's all you need to know. Forget about everything else. He's saying, no, this is just the beginning, but it's a good place to start from.
Yeah. Right.
And so I paraphrased Hillel in launching, that was at the end of the introduction to the book.
Yeah, and that was great. And so those seven words that you just said, be kind, don't panic, and have faith, those are the seven words that comprise three principles of, I guess, a healthy relationship. So let's talk a little bit about be kind, don't panic, and have faith. Those are the three principles. So when did you come up with that? It sounds like a while ago.
A long time ago, I don't know exactly, but 25 years anyway, or 20, something like that, you know, maybe a little less than that, early in my private practice, and I've been in private practice now for 26 years. So pretty early on, I was in a consultation group with some colleagues, and one of them, kind of on the way out, and it was a funny question, he said, how do you do couples therapy anyway? You know, as if one could answer that standing on one foot, you know? And I thought about it for a second, and I said, I suppose if you boil it all down, what I'm essentially telling people is be kind and don't panic. That's what I started with. Because, you know, the be kind is fairly obvious, although as I've developed it, I realized it's not just kindness like being nice to people. It's a radical respect for everybody's humanity. And it's especially, when you're talking about couple relationships, it's especially kindness in the sense of kinship, mm-hmm. you know, from the same root. It's like, it's not the same kindness you show to a stranger, which we should do. It's this particular sense of, yeah, you're also on my team. We're in this together, even if we're really annoyed at each other. So that kindness, and the only way you can be kind is when you're not in a panic. And so I realized so many of the techniques and practices I've been learning were all about helping people not panic. You know, ways of getting hold of yourself and calming down enough so that you can actually hear things that are disturbing without launching into unkindness. Mm-hmm. But I realized, so that was my initial statement of the theme. And then I realized when I kind of let that sit around in my mind for a few months, and I realized now the question then becomes, how do you not panic? And that's when I realized, well, the antidote to panic, and this is, of course, a rather grandiose statement, but the antidote to panic is to have faith, mm-hmm. by which I mean this fundamental sense that reality is right. That's what I mean by faith, that there's a rightness to it, even when we're suffering, even when it's really painful, even when it's beyond our understanding, because we haven't got a God's eye view of the universe. You know, we don't have all the data to possibly comprehend it. But there's something, faith says there's something right about the whole story. And that rightness is what lets us deal with lots of anxiety without it turning into panic. And that's how we can be kind. So that's kind of the genesis of the formula.
Great. And then that sort of informed your book's structure. Your first, as you said, there's an introduction, then you have a Part one, kindness. Part two, anxiety, which I assume is sort of associated with the panic factor. Part three is faith and forgiveness. Part four is applying all of these ideas. And then at the end of each chapter, you have reflections. And I liked that. That was those were really fun. They were sort of like little questions to ask yourself or exercises to do to take away from what you've just read about. And then there's also footnotes. And I have a question about the footnotes later, too. The whole book structure flowed very easily to me. And I wondered, was that sort of obvious to you how you wanted to structure the book? Maybe because you had those seven words that made it more obvious.
Oh, yeah. The seven words dictated the structure. It's like, okay, well, clearly, if I'm going to write this, that's how I'm going to structure it. And four parts, of course, the fourth part is now go and learn, right? So that's the part that where we apply that to various topics that come up a lot in the context of working with couples. So, in fact, my original title for this was Couples Therapy in Seven Words. My publisher said, why restrict it to therapy? It's really much more about relationships in general. And it was actually the publisher that came up with the title Reigniting the Spark. I think they figured that was, well, I had suggested like 30 titles or something like that. And they picked that one because it was, they wanted to have it be immediately obvious that this is applicable. You know, the reflection section you mentioned, I'm glad you liked that. It was not my idea. It was the publisher's idea.
Oh, really?
When they were editing the book, and they said, you know, you should put in some questions or exercises or something after each chapter. And so I said, okay, sure, I can do that. And so that's where those things came from.
And, you know, to me, it makes so much sense. I don't know. I'm not a psychologist or a psychotherapist, but it strikes me that when people come to you with questions about their relationships, there is work to be done, right? And so if they're going to be reading a book about these issues, then it's nice to have exercises and some sort of like way to sit down and do a little bit of work after you read each chapter, if I'm not oversimplifying that.
No, not at all. Yeah.
Now you have representative couples in the book, and you write that they are composites based on people that you have worked with. And obviously you couldn't use the real people that you've worked with. That was interesting to me. I'm sure after decades of doing this work, it was probably, there must be so many people that you've helped and whose problems you might have wanted to somehow include in the book. So how did you figure out who these couples, these composites were going to be? And were there people you wanted to include and you just simply couldn't?
Well, the with regard to the latter question, I couldn't include anybody where it was so specific,
right, sure,
that somebody might be identified. So, you know, but the kinds of couples that I, of course, I made them up, but I made them up based on real experiences. The kinds of couples I would make up were the ones that illustrated what I was trying to talk about. And of course, that's a circular process because the things I wanted to illustrate came out of my work with couples, right? So there are some themes that often come up. And so those are the couples that I created, the ones that really embodied those particular themes that I was trying to illustrate in the book. So I already mentioned, yeah, there were some folks I couldn't get real specific. I think I had a footnote where I mentioned I had several occasions over the past couple of years when I was writing the book, during especially the year or so that I was actively working on the book, I had several occasions to mention to people, you know, I've got a book coming out, and if you happen to, yeah, I just met you, and I already wrote this part, but it sure looks like you. It wasn't you, but it sure looks like you. And that has happened repeatedly over the past, you know, 6 or 8 months since the book was about to come out.
Isn't that funny?
I've reassured people, you know, if you happen to read the book, it isn't you, because I had already written this before I met you. But there are some themes that tend to occur.
Yeah.
And so those are the things I used.
Well, now, speaking of themes that tend to occur, one of your partners in the book, one of the composite partners, says, everything he does irritates me. I've turned into someone I don't want to be. And that struck me as very sad, but also somewhat universal. I feel like married people or people in relationships do get on each other's nerves, irritate each other. So this is kind of a two-part question. I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about that particular problem, but also, like, since it is sort of universal, when is it time for a couple to seek therapy if they are getting on each other's nerves? I mean, if their problems are on that level where it's just like, feels like this is sort of normal stuff, people do get on each other's nerves, do we need help?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. I don't have a formula for that one.
Okay.
Because it seems to be so, what I note, sometimes people come in when their problem is they got on each other's nerves. I think that's fairly rare, actually.
Oh, is it?
In my experience, when that's their only problem. Okay. Usually, it has risen to a different level. Mm. It's risen to the level where they're really wondering, is this viable or not? Can they stay in it or not? Because they're in a lot of pain by the time they come to me. I think it was another one of my footnotes. Parenthetically, when I recorded the audiobook, that hasn't come out yet. They're still working out some technical details, but I didn't know what to do with footnotes, so I just didn't include them in the audiobook. But I think they're sort of important. This is one where I quoted, it was John Gottman who often refers to this particular study, and I looked up the original study. Somebody said, how long was it? For a typical couple before they come in, before they seek therapy? How long have they been having problems before they seek therapy? And this study, which was done in the early 90s, it said something like 5 to 7 years. Hmm. And I often, I have a pretty standard question I ask people in the first session. Why are you here now as opposed to 6 months ago or 6 months from now? Was there some precipitating event? That question will often generate some really useful stories about, well, it turns out I just found out he or she's having an affair or whatever. But very, very often people will say, oh, we should have come in years ago. In hindsight, we should have come in years ago. So I don't have a formula for when people should come in. Usually they come in when it's hurting enough that they feel like they need some assistance. And there's a gendered piece to that a lot. Women are way, as a group, are way more interested in going to therapy than men are. As a man, I can totally relate to that. It's corollary to the fact that we men don't want to stop and ask for directions. It's that stereotype that seems to play out. It's way more often women setting up sessions than men. And if men are doing it, it's probably because the woman is saying either you do that or we're history. Mm. So, but in terms of when they should do it, I mean, they do it when it hurts enough. And I really respect that. And I also really respect people's caution around that. Because I have heard quite a few stories of really bad experiences people have had in couples therapy or really bad experiences people have had in individual therapy. And I admire the fact that people are willing to try it even when they've had bad experiences.
Now that brings up a good point. When people are thinking that they want to seek out a therapist to help them, how should they go about finding somebody who will be helpful as opposed to not?
Yeah, great question. Word of mouth, I suppose, and trial and error. That sort of question comes up. I happen to work in a practice where I'm the only male among 14 therapists. All the other therapists are women, and so every once in a while, I'll be given the referral because they are looking for a male. Or they're looking for a female, and of course, then it's going to go to somebody else. There's only a couple of us that do couples therapy, so I get a lot of, couples referrals. The point being that those sorts of preferences make sense to me, but it turns out that the individual, it's so much more important than any particular characteristic you can come up with. It makes it really difficult to know what to look for. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I'm fine for some people and not for others, and that's true of all of my colleagues as well. There's lots of really good therapists out there and lots of really not so great therapists out there, and everybody's good for some people and not for others. So you kind of have to try and see how it goes.
Yeah.
And I do feel that, some people will say, well, you have to give it 10 sessions or something like that. And I tend not to think that. I think if you go to a session or two or three and you find that you're feeling worse when you leave than when you got there, it's probably a bad fit.
Okay. I have this question. This is anecdotal, but I have a friend who's been going to a therapist with her husband literally for decades, I'm pretty sure. And mm-hmm. she calls it their date night. They go to couples therapy and then they go out for dinner. And she doesn't ever want it to end. She feels like it keeps their marriage together. Do you see this kind of situation in your practice? And what do you think of that as an approach?
So I want to put this in the context of my own preferences. I don't want to speak. I don't want to judge anybody
sure.
else's preferences.
Oh,
that's not fun for me. That work isn't fun for me. So I don't do that with people generally. I'm always wondering and often asking out loud, is this helping? Mm-hmm. And so for people who want to do it as their date night, and I respect that, But it just, that part isn't fun for me. Mm-hmm. I am more drawn, you know, I see this work as a sacred calling. Again, not to be too grandiose about it, but I see it as a sacred calling. And I want to help people who are, I want to help people who don't want to be working with me. Do you know what I mean? I mean, they want to be working with me. Do you know what I'm saying? I want to help people who whose goal is not to be in therapy because it's really cool to, you know, be in therapy. I want to help people who are suffering and want to not be suffering so much.
Right.
That's what I feel called to do. So when there are folks, I mean, it just, it seems to naturally work this way just in terms of how I approach it. When people come and they're saying, we're doing really well, I tend to be thinking, great, we don't need to be meeting that often, do we?
You know, right.
I don't mind checking in with people every few months. I do that on occasion. But it's just that, you know, to be doing it as someone in state night, which I respect, but it's not fun for me. So that's
okay.
There's my answer.
That's a good answer. Now, at one point in the book, you talk about a moral compass and how people have a moral compass, or you know, hopefully people have a moral compass. People know what's right, what's wrong, etc. That just jumped out at me, and I wondered if we can talk about that on a larger scale, not just about couples, but sort of, do people have a moral? I mean, I feel like I see the world today, and I feel like people don't always have a moral compass, not the way I thought they did. And not to get political necessarily, but what do you, like, as you read the news, do you feel like that there's, people have a moral compass?
Oh yeah. I do. Actually, you know, I, in having listened to some of your interviews, I know you have a question you often ask about books that, you know, that might be recommended. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't mean to hop out of your sequence here.
No,
but
wherever it fits, that's great.
Yeah. And the one of the ones I'm going to mention is a book by Jonathan, I think he pronounces it Haidt, but H-A-I-D-T, Jonathan Haidt, or Haidt, however you pronounce it. Funny if he pronounces it Haidt, given his topic. And my favorite of his books, I've read a couple of his books. My favorite one is called The Righteous Mind. He published it not long, I think it was not long after the 2012 presidential election. He's a psychologist who studies moral development. And he has a theory that he refers to as, I think, what is it called? Moral foundations, I think. I may be getting the term wrong. But he talks about the notion of different pillars of morality that are important to different people. In a way, it's really interesting in how it explains the differences among, let's say, as the terms as we've used them in this country, among people toward the left, you know, liberals in general, conservatives in general, and libertarians in general.
Yes.
And it's not that people, you know, it's easy for people in one camp to look at the others and say, wow, you don't seem to have a moral compass. But the issue isn't so much that people lack a moral compass. The issue is that what they consider crucial in their moral compass varies a lot among different groups. And it's sometimes hard to see that. So, no, I think there's plenty of morality around. There's a lot of conflict about it. When I talk about people having a moral compass, I don't claim to, you know, I don't claim to have a direct line to God. You know, I don't, I keep trying to get, you know, Verizon to fix it, and they're not able to fix it. So, as I occasionally explain to people, so I don't know, we have to be responsible for the choices we make and recognize that those choices are necessarily fallible. But that doesn't absolve me of the responsibility of having a moral compass. Mm-hmm. It's just that where it gets interesting and difficult is where the moral, you know, morality clashes around different things that we consider vital to morality.
Okay, that's great. Well, actually, while we're on that, why don't we continue? What else have you read lately that you might recommend to listeners?
Yeah, you know, people often ask me, in terms of doing therapy work, people often ask, you know, what books should I read? And they're thinking often like, what sort of self-help books? And Having written a book, which I suppose fits in the self-help category, I am pretty leery of self-help books. And I'll tell you, I don't know if I accomplished what I'm about to say in my book or not, but what I hope to accomplish, what I look for in any books, any of the sort of books in the genre that I enjoy, always have what I've always referred to for years as sort of a twinkle in the author's eye. What's the twinkle in the author's eye? It's this recognition underneath all of it that, you know, I don't have all the answers either. You do know that, right? You know, it's that one. The ones that claim to have all the answers just leave me flat. And so often, and I will answer your question about a couple of books I actually do recommend, but what I often recommend to people is read a good novel. if you want to know about human relationships, and it's kind of a circular statement, what makes a good novel? A novel that's really good about human relationships. A novel that isn't so simple. A novel where everybody isn't predictable. You know, there's a genre of therapy called narrative therapy that I got lots of training in and been influenced by a lot. And one of its ways of looking at is that no one narrative captures all of reality. A good novel the characters won't be completely predictable. If they're completely predictable, it's basically a morality play and it's kind of boring. And good therapy is like that, I think. Good therapy has that same characteristic of a good novel. It's things, you notice things that don't fit the dominant narrative, which tends to be pretty oppressive. It's what brings people into therapy. So read a good novel, and often that'll be something that will inform you better than a lot of the self-help books. Having said that, a couple of authors I think are definitely worth recommending. Esther Perel has two well-known books out. I'm not sure if she's written any other ones, but her two well-known books, one is called Mating in Captivity, mm-hmm. and the other is The State of Affairs. I had read The State of Affairs before I wrote my book. After I finished it and it was at the publisher's, then I read Mating in Captivity. And as I started to read it, I had one of those horrifying experiences where you look and say, oh, my God, she's written my book only better. You know, but fortunately, I have to say, no, she didn't quite because she didn't do the faith stuff. My brand, you know, my distinguishing characteristic in the book is my coverage of faith. But she, having said that, she's really... I like her style. I don't agree with everything she says, but of course, we shouldn't agree with everything anybody says. But I do like her style, and I recommend her books. And then anything by John and Julie Gottman tends to be useful. They've written a lot about... John Gottman is the one of the two who's done research for decades about couples. And I'm often referring to his research stuff when I talk to couples, because... he bases a lot of his conclusions on some very empirical kinds of research. You know, he basically says, never mind what we're supposed to know, let's look at what real couples actually do. And so he brought in couples as newlyweds, interviewed them and measured their physiology and did all sorts of things with them, and then followed the same couples for, in some cases, over 20 years. Mm. Brought them in, I think, like every 3 years. And he found out various things that seemed to, if you look back at the newlywed data, these are the things that distinguish the couples that did well with each other from the couples who ended up either being miserable together or breaking up. And so that's really useful stuff.
Is he the one who you mentioned in the book about someone who did graphs? Interesting to look at the graphs of how couples you felt emotionally over a 15-minute period of time when they were having an argument, maybe. Or
exactly, yeah. Yeah, and that particular one, it's really amusing because... this particular couple the graph that I mentioned in the book, their emotionality, this measure of emotionality, looks perfectly synchronized. I liken it to ice dancers, you know? It's like they're so perfectly synchronized. Isn't that romantic? But of course, it's a trick question because that couple were triggering each other. It's not like this was a graph of their having sex or having, you know, a lovely time together and they were stimulating joy. They were triggering each other's anger. And the problem is they were losing it. And couples with that kind of graph tend to, something gets out of control at some point. It either goes to violence or somebody crosses some line. And so that's a dangerous kind of graph to have. The couples that did well were able to be out of sync when necessary. Mm-hmm. That's one of the chief skills of intimacy. Which is another topic we can talk about if you want to, stability and intimacy. That's mm-hmm. That is another of my sort of important concepts in the book. One of the chief skills of intimacy is the ability to be out of sync with your partner when necessary so that you don't freak out when they're freaking out. And the couples that could do that would help calm each other down rather than freak each other out.
Yeah, you have, let me see if I can find, you have a line in the book that I thought was interesting. My panic can easily become your panic. I don't know if that's related to what you're saying, where, you know.
That is very much, yeah.
Yeah. So, Yeah. Anyway, that's just interesting. I'm actually going to back up, though. You were joking about not having a line to God and Verizon should fix that. But you have this great moment in the book where you say that you feel utterly unqualified to tell someone what to do.
Yes.
And I liked that because I feel like that's a sign of humility, which is something I would want in a therapist. But is that because it's presumptuous? And I feel like often you must have thoughts about what someone should do, even if you are reluctant to direct them. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Well, of course it's true. But when I'm doing that, I'm not working very well. Of course it's true. You know, there will be these moments when I'm thinking, oh, for crying out loud, if you just do X, Y, or Z, can't you see that you're messing things up? You know, but if I try not to say that, good. But I also try not to think it. When I'm thinking that, that's a really, from the therapist's point of view, that's a recipe for burnout. Uh-huh. People burn out when they think that way. If I'm trying to sell somebody, if I'm presumptuous enough to think that I could live their life better than they can, first of all, I just as a matter of principle, I think it's wrong. It's baloney. I can't. It's more than presumptuous. It's dangerously presumptuous. And I will say, I am frequently, I guess frequently is not the wrong word. I'm frequently horrified by what I hear people quoting other therapists as telling them to do. It's like, oh my God, somebody's presuming to tell you to do something often against their own values or against their own judgment because they think it'll fix the problem. As opposed to saying, have you thought about this? You know, I try to be very clear. I'm perfectly willing to offer people ideas. Otherwise, what are they coming to me for? You know, I'm happy to offer ideas. I just don't want to, I always want to situate them in the fact that it's just somebody having some ideas. I have lots of experience working with folks and I'm an old guy, right? I'm about 69 years old now. So I've lived a while, you know, that qualifies me for something. But I don't want to pretend that I know better than someone else how to live their lives. I just think, and it isn't, and also, aside from everything else, I think I mentioned this in the book too, it's ineffective. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work to tell somebody to do something they don't want to do. It can work to raise ideas and, you know, offer, you know, stimulate their thinking about it, but it doesn't do any good to tell somebody to do something they don't want to do. And as I say, it's a recipe for burnout and it doesn't help people. Mm-hmm.
Now, I think in that same section, you wrote about a client who had enough theorizing. Mm-hmm. That person was the one who wanted to be told what to do. And so you said, just be nice to her. I really liked this moment. But I could also really relate to someone having had enough theorizing. Does that come up very often?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a function of experience. You know, the longer I've done the work, because early on, and I'm kind of a cerebral person. Actually, my name, Bruce Chalmer, the letters can be arranged to spell cerebral chum. my kids discovered this when they were in high school. Just recently, somebody, one of my kids' high school friends on Facebook said, oh, what is cerebral chum? Think about this. I just thought that was funny. So I tend to be kind of cerebral, you know. So I am prone to over-theorizing. And earlier, especially in my career, I could get really enamored of the theories du jour. And that is one of the things one learns with experience, I think, is not to get so enamored of one's own theories.
Yeah.
And so I kind of had to relax about that. Yeah, that particular moment you mentioned in the book, that was a real moment. Again, I did change the details, but that was a very real moment. And it was early in my practice.
Yeah.
And he just wanted me to tell him, you're the expert, Doc. You know, what should we do? And so I said, well, you know, be nice to her. Listen to her. She's telling you not to make fun of her. Don't make fun of her.
Right.
And he implemented that. And they came back a couple of weeks later. And it's like, thanks. That took care of the problem. And she was relaxed and happy. And, you know, that was a useful moment for me in my own development.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of many examples in your book where it seems almost like not the fear necessarily, but the danger that's perceived around honesty and, you know, exposure of what might be going wrong is keeping people from getting to a level of happiness and comfort. And those are my words, not yours, but it felt like that was a bit of a theme, mm-hmm. that people are afraid of confronting honestly what's going on.
Yeah, that actually, that's the theme of intimacy as opposed to stability. You know, that's which maybe I can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
That stability and intimacy, I didn't invent either term, obviously. I adapted those terms from some other ideas that other people had, of course. That's not a totally original idea.
Yeah.
But we're all after both. Those are needs. And I use the term needs carefully because we can say we need things. You know, people use that term a whole lot when what they really mean is they have certain desires. And I'm saying needs because if you don't have enough stability and enough intimacy, something feels sick. Something really goes wrong. It just doesn't work. And stability is every bit as important as intimacy. But most of the people who come to see me, there are exceptions, but most of the couples who come to see me are pretty good at stability. You know, to show up in a therapist's office and either have insurance or have enough money to pay for it. And, you know, generally speaking, they know how to work the system and they know how to, you know, they're lucky and they're skilled, you know, the combination. So they're pretty good at keeping things stable, which is all about lowering or avoiding anxiety. You know, being able to know how to be employed or know how to, you know, work with the system so that you have a roof over your head and enough food to eat. Those are really important things. Working out the roommate issues with your partner. You know, most of the couples I see, if they've been together for a long time, they're not usually coming to see me because they're driving each other crazy with where they put the toothpaste. So, you know, those are stability skills and they're important, but usually they're okay with that. The problem is the intimacy side, which is related to that concept of being just fundamentally emotionally honest with yourself and each other. And that is what that requires isn't that you lower or avoid anxiety. That actually requires that you tolerate anxiety and even be willing to raise it. And a lot of couples, especially long-term couples with kids and, you know, lives that they built together, are quite understandably afraid to risk that when they're worried that it could risk the entire structure, it could risk stability. So they will tend to privilege stability over intimacy. The problem is, and one of my favorite metaphors, stability is like the roots of a relationship. It holds it in place. Intimacy is the energy for growth. And if you stifle that, then it will wither. Mm-hmm. Then the relationship will die even if it's stable. And so a lot of times the crisis that brings people in is a crisis of intimacy of one kind or another. That's, of course, not just referring to sex, although sex is often part of it, but referring more generally to feeling like you can be who you are in the presence of your partner being who they are. And that's a very important thing for a relationship, but often people have lost each other because it's too scary to do that.
Hmm. That's really interesting. Mm. Thought about this issue I'm about to ask you about before when it comes to children and being in school and bullying and just feeling so grateful that there weren't cell phones when I was in school, for example. But it struck me in reading this book that, my goodness, social media and cell phones have made marriage, well, it's certainly changed the presentation of certain kinds of problems and created new challenges, I think, as far as people who look up old boyfriends or girlfriends, people who are cheating. And of course, cell phones, I have a number of anecdotal instances of friends in my life who found out about somebody cheating through a cell phone. So has that changed marriage, or has it just changed the way people betray each other?
It's changed how people get busted.
Yeah.
I think that's what you've noticed. And I've noticed that too over the years. You know, I've been doing it long enough that when I started in my private practice, there were very few cell phones, and then, you know, then cell phones and then texting and then, you know, then social media came in. So it definitely changes how people get busted. I don't know. I mean, I haven't done research. I don't know if it's changed how often people actually cheat. People have been cheating for a long time.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't know if it's changed the percentages. That is an interesting phenomenon about the ways people cheat. And, of course, a couple of the couples in my book, the examples I gave, which, again, I have lots of people to choose from in, you know, putting together those couples, it was not even in person. It was by texting or sexting. And so, you know, that's a new thing. But the phenomenon of people, you know, seeking relationships outside their marriage that somehow conflict with their marriage vows, that's, of course, not a new phenomenon at all.
Okay. Do you mind if I read one of your footnotes?
Please feel free.
Okay. So you write, I loved this. You write, if you don't find your partner's negative reactions unpleasant, perhaps that's because you aren't detecting your partner's distress. If you're not skilled at picking up those cues, which is one way of being neuroatypical, e.g. Asperger's syndrome, working with a therapist with expertise in neuroatypicality can help you develop the skills you need to improve your relationship. If, on the other hand, you do detect your partner's negative reactions but don't find them unpleasant, or worse, you enjoy them, then you're a sociopath and shouldn't be in an intimate relationship. Of course, if that's you, you're very unlikely to be reading this book, so it probably isn't you. I loved that.
I'm glad you liked it. I had fun writing it, I will say.
I was looking for a footnote to use as a question about including footnotes, and then I thought I loved that there were humor in them, and that, you know, it's very often I think people skip footnotes because it's not part of the bulk of the book, but it's such a mistake. You need to read the footnotes. It's really fun.
Yeah. And I have to say, I was really glad that there are footnotes and not endnotes for that reason. And I've always been a sort of compulsive endnote reader, because I've always felt like, ooh, there's probably some gem in there that I don't want to miss, you know? And I always like it when occasionally a book will be organized so that the endnotes are merely bibliographical references. So you don't have, you know, there's no substance there other than it's there if you want to look up the original, which I really appreciate. But that the footnotes are right there on the page so you can, you know, you can jump down to them. And I mentioned earlier, and I didn't know what to do about them with the audiobook, so I left them out, unfortunately. So that's... Because I don't know how to, I saw somebody who did, in an audiobook, who did footnotes by changing their tone of voice. Somebody actually did it where they changed the timbre of the sound to sound like they were talking on a telephone. I thought that was a very clever way to do it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I didn't know what to do about it in that. But yeah, I thought the footnotes were important.
You could have Judy do them.
And how do you know? Yeah, we actually considered that. She's got a great voice. We actually considered doing that and thought, nah, that's going to be too weird. So we just didn't do it.
It'd be like David Sedaris bringing his sister in.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. Yeah. But the thing about, you know, about footnotes, I mean, I did wrestle with this, you know, and this is a broadcast about writing, you know, about the writing process. So as a writer of a nonfiction book, you know, I was kind of wrestling with that question of what do I do if it's enough to be worth saying it, shouldn't it be in the text? Except there is something really kind of useful about this parenthetical approach that's out of the body, but it's still, you know, out of the body of the work, but it's still important.
Yeah.
It's still worth saying, but it, you know, it sort of takes you to another reflective space and then you go back to the main text. So that's why I included them.
Yeah. I thought they were great. And let's talk a little bit. You were talking about this is a show for writers. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your path to publication, because that's an important part of any writer's journey. How did you find your publisher?
I web search. I looked all over the place. And as I'm sure you know, and your listeners, many of your listeners know as writers, there's a lot of different models now. You know, this is my second published book. The first one was in 1986. It was a statistics textbook.
Okay.
So, boy, the world was different in 1986 from what it is now. You know, I sent in a manuscript on, you know, that stuff called paper, you know. You heard of it?
I
sent that in, and you know, we weren't doing email. We were writing letters back and forth. I mean, that's how it was done back in 1986. And nowadays, of course, there are all these different models. There's the traditional publishing model, and then there's the hybrid models where you pay for part of it. There's, of course, the models where you're self-publishing, basically. You know, there's all these different approaches, which on all of which I consider it is clearly, and I invite your comment on this, but as far as I could tell, it is no longer considered vaguely reprehensible to self-publish. Mm-hmm. It's quite respectable nowadays, and for good reason. It's like, great, you know, that's people can do that. But I was fortunate to find this quirky publisher out in... You'd think I'd know where he is. It's kind of a testimony. I think it's Indianapolis. I keep forgetting. I think it's Indianapolis where he is. TCK Publishing. It's named after the owner's name, Tom Corson Knowles. And he is a traditional publisher, but he's really geared toward getting things out quickly and, you know, really geared toward helping authors who aren't necessarily established, you know, with lots of other publications get published. So I really appreciated that. So I didn't have to pay him, you know, he'll pay me royalties if it sells well enough. I mean, he offers a pretty generous royalty. And he came up with a design and, provided professional editing services and all the stuff that a publisher can do. So I was really grateful to be able to find that. I showed it to some traditional publishers, got some interest, but they said, you know, a couple of ones said, well, this is very nice, but we have titles just like it.
Okay.
So, you know, the ones I would think of are the ones that already publish books like that. And for that reason, they're not interested in another one.
Right.
So that's how I got there.
Another circle, like you were talking about before. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so I tend to finish these interviews by asking for advice for writers. But in your case, I want to ask on two levels. I wonder if you, and I know that it's hard to sum this up with all that you've written, and there's so much great advice in your book, but I wondered if you have advice for being a good partner, but also about writing about relationships, maybe in life, or also for people who are writing about relationships in fiction. Do you have any advice about those? So there's a few questions there to pick on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, with respect to advice for people writing about relationships, wow, this is funny. It's almost like when a couple asks me, what should I do? You know, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm not qualified to, I'm not qualified to tell a fiction writer, you know, you're a writer yourself, you know,
yeah.
There's some amazingly talented writers about there. I'm just in awe of that. You know, I would love to be able to write fiction and never really, I mean, I've dabbled a little and don't seem to have much talent for it yet. I mean, maybe someday, but you know, so I don't know what to tell them. It's really similar to what I tell couples. It's like, I don't have answers for you, but I hope I can ask a lot of good questions. And I suppose the way you get to writing well about this is far, boy, this sounds like it's, this is so Jewish what I'm saying right now, by the way. And pretty much whatever I say seems to me, it's like so Jewish to say this, that it's not so much about what the answer is, it's about asking the right questions and then wrestling with the questions. So, you know, the good books I read, be they nonfiction, you know, sort of advice type books or novels or about relationships, are the ones that are wrestling with the questions. It's more interesting to me when they're wrestling with it than when they come up with a nice pat answer.
Okay, wonderful. That's wonderful advice. The title of the book is Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back by Bruce Chalmer and published by TCK Publishing. Bruce, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today about your book, but also about all these important concerns for couples. Thank you.
Well, thank you. This has been delightful.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Vermont author Dr. Bruce Chalmer. His new book is Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back, just out from TCK Publishing. More information about his work can be found at Dr. Chalmer's website, brucechalmer.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Bruce Chalmer. In writing about relationships, consider the scary moments as being perhaps the most useful to write about. Not necessarily moments when you and your partner are disagreeing, but perhaps moments when you are delighted by something and you aren't sure if your partner feels the same way, and the not knowing is scary. Consider moments where you are looking at the possibility of intimacy. Dr. Chalmer advises that's the stuff to write about. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. All of these events are, of course, virtual, thanks to the quarantine. White River Indie Films will offer a viewing of Vermont filmmaker Nora Jacobson's in-progress documentary about the poetry and life of Green Mountain State poet Ruth Stone. A live remote Q&A with the filmmaker follows. That's Tuesday, May 19th at 7. More information about this online event is available by emailing info at wrif.org. Bear Pond Books in Montpelier will have a virtual meeting of its sci-fi and book club. This week, they'll be discussing American Hippo by Sarah Gailey. That's tonight, May 18th at 7. For more information, you can email kimwardvermont@gmail.com. The North Shire Bookstore in Manchester Center will have an online discussion with the author John Grisham, whose new novel is Camino Winds, Thursday, May 21st at noon. More information about this event is available at northshire.com. On their website, the South Burlington Public Library lets us know that the Vermont Humanities Council will be offering an online lecture with Rebecca Rupp, author of Gardening with a Twist, The Surprising History of Vermont Garden Vegetables. That's May 21st at 6:30. You can get more information about that event by emailing sbplinfo@southburlingtonvt.gov. And then finally, the North Shire Bookstore in Manchester Center will have another online event, a conversation with Vermont author Stephen Kiernan, Thursday, May 21st at 5. More information at northshire.com. Upcoming interviews on Write the Book include next week a conversation with American mystery and crime writer Jeffrey Deaver. His new Coulter Shaw adventure is The Goodbye Man. And then also next week, I'll have a conversation with the author Alka Joshi about her new novel, The Henna Artist, which is a Reese Witherspoon and Hello Sunshine book club pick. So I hope that you are all staying safe. I hope that you're able to read and to write. And if possible, I hope you are able to support authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs and virtual book tours, and finding your way to their books. And if you're trying to write in isolation, do be sure to check the archives of Write the Book, because each episode, as you probably know, offers a prompt. And each week's prompt is written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. It's also mentioned during the interview. I would love your feedback about Write the Book. Let me know if you'd like me to reach out to certain authors and ask them for interviews, or if you have events to announce. If you like the show, I really appreciate it. If you like it on Facebook, rate it in whatever venue you get your podcast from, and be sure to tell your friends about it. And also let them know about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com, which is a place that you can go to find the archived interviews. We're also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and Google Play and all the other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com, which is just a mnemonic for helping you spell my first name. If you have particularly good luck with any of our weekly Write the Book prompts, send them to writethebook@gmail.com. And if there's time, I will try to share it on the air and credit you for it, of course. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Take care, stay well, and have a great week.